Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity. Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, where I'm delighted to be joined by David Bloxham, CEO of GCS Recruitment Specialist. I first got to know David some years ago when we started working together to support David's company in Poland. I've always enjoyed my conversations with David, and I'm sure you will too. David, how are you doing, my friend?
Yeah, not too bad at all. As I said, it's March, so it's a budget season. So, yeah, doing the politics of getting the numbers right for next year. But other than that, all good.
Good, man. Well, David, a warm welcome to the show. So great to have you on and really excited for our conversation. So, David, for the benefit of our audience, what's the David story? How did you become the CEO over at GCS? What was your journey?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been in recruitment 25 years, so a long time. And I joined GCS 25 years ago, maybe 26 years ago now, actually. So when we were three people, and obviously grown with the business now, I think we're up to about 150 people now. And really kind of grown with the business. You know, my story is that, like many people getting into recruitment, I didn't really have a clue what recruitment was and whether I would enjoy it. But as soon as I did it, I really loved it, love the excitement of it. And I love the fact that you're helping people, helping customers, and no day is the same. So, you know, part of my story is that I'm doing a job I really love and also very proud of what we, as myself and the team, have really achieved within GCS as well. We've grown, expanded to different continents, locations, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously we're in technology and we supply kind of, you know, really, really high level talent to really, really innovative companies. So that's really interesting. But obviously, if you were going to choose a market to be working in over the last 25 years, then IT would be one of those. So, you know, the story itself is how we have expanded alongside our market from kind of small beginnings in Reading to now where we've got offices, you know, in Ireland, UK, mainland Europe, and in the US as well. I did leave GCS for a few years, so I worked as well for Harvey Nash and Alexander Mann, and then came back when there was an opportunity to be the MD. And as MD, I worked very closely with the founder, a guy called Chris Bartlett, and my senior management team, people like Lisa Forrester, Tim Dunn, Lawrence Kelly, to push towards an MBO. So we did an MBO where we joined Engage, which is a kind of recruitment platform based in the UK. 20 other different brands, and that's when I became CEO. So once we exited the founder and myself and the senior management team were running the company, we were able to, you know, I became CEO. And it's been a really, really exciting ride in the last few years, you know, with the backing of Engage. We've really managed to kind of, you know, triple sales, triple profits, you know, expand in lots of locations. And obviously one of those has been Poland, and that's how we got to start speaking, Conor, because you need good support to deal in new locations. That's for sure.
Oh, well, thanks, David, and it's been a pleasure, I have to say. And David, I hadn't thought to ask this question, and I hope you don't mind it. So on our podcast, we've been very lucky to have a whole range of guests, but probably the vast majority of the guests to date have been coming from what I would describe as the platform economy, or almost like talent marketplaces that are really seeking to, hate to use this term, but it's come up a lot, disintermediate recruitment companies like your own, right? Essentially, they're saying, we can do this cheaper, faster, better. And do you know what, David? I would have subscribed to that view myself when I set up my own platform, which failed, right? So that failed, and loads of other platforms have failed. And recruitment companies and staffing companies have went from strength to strength. You know, if you look at and talk to most recruitment company CEOs, particularly the larger ones like you and others, as you go up that sort of chain, the Manpowers, the Tapfins, the Randstads, that they're all flying. So really my question, David, is what can recruitment companies be disintermediate intermediate by these platforms, or have recruitment companies got something special that the platforms can't match, marry, or do?
Well, obviously, I would answer yes, we do have something special. I think that when we talk about the talent marketplaces and automating the recruitment system, even you could bring in kind of internal talent teams into that.
Yes.
The way we see is if our overall remit is to supply expert talent to innovative companies, right? There's many, many innovative, we work in the tech market, but this is, you know, for any growing market, for any area where there's, you know, talent shortages. The area that we exist in is within passive candidates, right? So active candidates are going to be immediately looking for a job, going to be supplying themselves to a job, and they're going to be, you know, applying for jobs, right?
Yes.
Within the markets that we work within, there are not many active candidates. So there are many jobs that are left unfilled, okay? So the service we provide, you know, I would expect, you know, a talent marketplace to be able to fill 25% of the jobs, you know. I would expect an internal talent team to be able to fill, you know, 33, maybe if they're fantastic, you know, 90% of the jobs. There will always be 10% of jobs that will be left unfilled. And it's therefore for the company to argue, do we leave these jobs unfilled, or do we use the experts that can tap into a much wider network and are constantly looking in specialist areas for these people in order to, you know, fill these jobs? And I think that's the service that I've always spoken about. We work as partners with talent teams, and you know, we know that we supplement, you know, referral schemes. We know that we supplement people's job board activities, LinkedIn activities, you know, everything really. We supplement that, and I think that's the key thing. The other thing that obviously we have that particularly the automated systems don't have is human beings. Right.
Yes.
And recruitment is a very human thing. You know, a computer cannot, you know, build a rapport. A system cannot, you know, sell especially well as, you know, I'd hope our recruitment consultants can do. So we go out as a representative either of the candidate or the client, and we sell them, and we facilitate the process. And as you know, Connor, I know you've been in recruitment yourself,
yes,
right? There's a lot of hours, yes, that go into that. You know, it's not an easily automatable process.
No.
So, you know, I personally tend not to worry too much about it, because I think you can get too caught up in it in terms of, oh, there's all this competition. There will always be a place for recruitment businesses. And at the moment, with the level of, you know, active candidates is very low, and obviously the demand's very high, right? You know,
yes,
you know, we know that it goes in circles, you know, when there's downturns, as we obviously experienced in COVID. But I mean, I've been in the industry, as I said, 25 years. It becomes more of a client focused market, you know, and then obviously, you know, we have to deal with that in our way. But generally, in my experience, there's always been a need for recruiters that can do a really good job. So, you know, it sorts itself out over the time.
Yeah, I like your analysis there, David. And, you know, I was in IT staffing for many years myself, and I always considered the best recruiters, and I include myself in this without sounding too egotistical, I hope, as a talent advisor. I mean, the best recruiters know their market and their candidates inside out. I mean, I can still probably tell you the best 10 Cisco network engineers in Ireland, right? The top 5 CCIE Cisco architects.
You can tell it to me if you want, Connor, because we're
I'll send you after. But you know, that ability to market map, but also advise the candidate and the client, I think is often overlooked. And I find and feel that recruiters, they get a bad bloody rap, David, right? And in many cases, it's often unfair, right? And you know, recruiters do a valuable job. That 10% segment that you mentioned in a large company that can't be filled by internal talent acquisitions, teams or technology is an important segment, right? And you're really helping businesses get ahead by getting access to the people that they need. And I haven't seen a tool or a platform that has fully automated that process successfully and at scale, right? Okay. And at scale. I think maybe the platforms might come into their own, David, where the rules are repeatable and the same, if not similar, right? So let's say you need 100 operators to, you know, work in a plant or a factory line, or 100 events people, or even, you know, 20 IT help desk people with the same skills, yeah, right? Maybe that's where the matching tools work. But in a way, I always think that the best recruiters are a bit like football agents, right? There's a hidden hand to the market, right? Whereby you're able to influence people's careers and organizations by being that true talent advisor. And I see companies like Allegis moving into that, whereby, you know, in my day, you were a recruitment consultant or a salesperson, basically, and your job was to sell. But I see Allegis are rebranding their recruiters, or some of the recruiters anyway, as talent consultants, talent advisors. And then they've got a large team of technology and shared services resources behind the scenes doing that resourcing piece. But I had a question, David. Like when I started out, you know, it wasn't quite the fax machine time, right? but I think LinkedIn was just taking off. It was 2007. I started my recruitment career, and LinkedIn was like, we started using it. We're like, oh my God, this is like the best thing since sliced bread. This is really going to change our life, right? And then, you know, the recruitment CRMs like Bullhorn and whatnot came into the market, and they started improving your search capability and your matching. But is there some automation tools or technology that's changed your business, David, and how your top consultants perform?
I think that, you know, I mean, just going back to, you know, what we're just saying about the talent marketplaces there is that obviously one of the key things that recruitment has on its side is that we do our work for free until it's successful. Whereas most of these things you're kind of paying, you're paying for up front, right? So you can't really see the return on investment from these specific places. Also, and this links into what you're just saying, we link into all the different, you know, tools. You know, we will have access to all the different tools so that we are kind of like the robot looking for them, but except this time we're a robot with a voice and that you don't have to pay for up front. So what we try to do is be as customer focused as possible. Now, the reason we do that is probably, I would say, to try to decrease the reliance on as many tools as we possibly can and use our own networks. So we're always creating very specific networks for our customers and market mapping. And this goes back to what you were just saying about talent there. Is if I'm working with a client in a specific location for the specific skill set, then what I'm always trying to build is a market map, a talent map, as it were, of these types of people. I'm also trying to portray that client as the best. So we do a lot of work. You just talked there about, you know, services. Do Lockaware and AEVP. We have our own Connect kind of network and different events, meetups, services that we provide. And it's all around really kind of, if we're talking about companies that we work with, innovative companies, making them appear to be the most innovative, you know, the most kind of fantastic company to work for. So again, kind of coming back to it, you know, LinkedIn is a huge part of the way we source candidates. But what is important for me is that we take that network from LinkedIn and then build those personal relationships, which we use within our own CRM. Yeah. And really the most important thing is automation should bring you in a network. And then it's down to your own, you know, if we're talking about this being a people-based business, it's down to yourself to build, cultivate and manage that network, you know. So, yeah, I mean, there's always great new tools kind of coming about. You know, you know, we use some of the great ones like kind of Lusher and Zoom Info and that sort of stuff, which obviously allow you to kind of contact more candidates directly. You know, I think, you know, for myself, each tool that comes in does not necessarily increase productivity. It just gives you a new route to market that you can speak to people. What increased productivity is highly trained recruitment consultants that use those networks to basically, you know, build, you know, finely managed, you know, compliant networks, which then they can use for their customers, if that makes sense.
It does. And David, without getting too much into the nitty-gritty of your business, but I always thought, and I still think this, and I'm going to use the word control. I don't mean that in its traditional sense, but I always feel if you can control the candidate, and what I mean by that is you've got ownership in a way of the candidate. You've got that firm, solid relationship where the candidate sees you as that trusted advisor, as that talent partner to get them the best possible contract or permanent job. I was going to say contract or permanent job. That if you've got that level of relationship and that control, David, that essentially allows you to control the market, if that makes sense. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, that's why we try to work as specialists and really try to, you know, understand and know our market and know our customers. You know, control for me is making sure that the service that you're providing to both sides, client and candidate, is really, really good. You know, no one should be surprised. Everyone should be prepared. Everyone should know what's happening and when the offer is coming and when the interview is happening, what's going to happen in the interview and what's the candidate like, you know, and, you know, everything really. That to me is about control. And it's not, like you said, it's not necessarily a negative thing. It's a positive thing. And I think people respect that and react well to that. So
the other thing that came to mind, David, and I want to come on to some of the topics that we also want to discuss with you, is that there's been a lot of commentary in newspapers around that the power has moved back to the employee or the worker, right? That they control the market, that they control their salaries, and of course there's wage inflation and everything like that at the moment. And my question really is, David, are you seeing a lot of margin pressure from clients and things like that, or is there a sort of awareness from clients now that they need to pay more to get the best people and win that war of talent?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, specifically talking about the UK, you know, for me, it's you know, there are many price pressures, you know, in terms of, you know, obviously the cost of things, salary inflation, national insurance changes they're making in the UK now. So we probably will have to speak to our clients and talk to them about kind of, you know, increases, which we don't usually do. Usually kind of put that within your own margin. But yeah, there are huge kind of cost increases and salary inflation within the market. I think clients are aware of that. You know, if you think about recruitment as a service, you know, and you're getting energy bills, they're going up, and you're getting, you know, your rent, that's probably going up, you know, your everything, your home, you know, utilities, etc., etc., your TV fee, etc., etc., that's all going up, right? So, you know, if you see, and hopefully we've developed that with our customers, that we're a partner, you know, you would expect that. It is tough. In that area at the moment, in the fact that, you know, there's so much demand that salaries are increasing, and there's so much opportunity that, you know, people have more opportunities to look around. So yeah, we've got to be very careful of that, and obviously as a business, it's something that, you know, you have to keep very aware of. Like I said, budget season at the moment, you've got to keep aware of those types of things. And costs are going up to us, and, you know, our costs will go up and our prices probably will go up. And, you know, I think all businesses are kind of dealing with that at the moment. But I guess that's inflation, really, you know. And you know, obviously we've been through some tough times over the last couple of years. And I'm sure that things probably won't get necessarily easier. But yeah, I mean, in the end, one thing I always think about is, you know, as a business, you know, if there are, you know, price and inflationary pressures, then obviously our charges kind of go up a commensurate to the kind of salaries as well. So it does kind of even itself out, but it's something that we have to be very aware of.
Yeah, and David, we did a webinar with Randstad Source right there before Christmas, and a big topic of the conversation was around candidate counter offers, right? Then a lot of candidates are getting like blown away, like in some cases double or triple counter offers to stay. So are you guys seeing that at GCS amongst your candidate communities? Are you getting churned and burned at the last minute, even if you have that great relationship with the candidate?
Yes, and we are seeing quite a lot. One of the things I talked about controlling the process, and this is also like working very closely with customers specifically, is you have to be prepared for it all the way along. You know, one of the things we train our people on very much is no surprises. So if a counter offer is a surprise at the end, then that wasn't very good control along the process, right? So you should definitely be aware that there's going to be a counter offer. You know, if you're placing a, let's say, a Python developer or a data scientist that's currently working, the companies they're working for will not let them leave easily. So it always happens, and it's happening a lot more now. I think what's important really for me is that you think as you're going along about the motivations of your candidate, you know, why they want to move. If it's just for money, that's always a kind of worry for me. It's going back to basics of recruitment, really. You know, nothing should be a surprise, and you should have covered all kind of eventualities as you go through the process. Mm-hmm. But I do think that one of the important things is when you're working with a company is letting them know what the market rates are. You know, we do this quite a lot within GCS. You know, we push back with our customers in terms of what they're paying, you know, the offers and the benefits. You know, remote working, for instance, is a really good example. You know, if a client's kind of coming to us and saying it's fully in the office, then that is very different. And so there will be some candidates that like that, right? But if the majority of clients are saying it's remote or hybrid, particularly in IT, and you're saying you've got to be in the office all the time, we will push back and say, look, you know, we can find you people. You know, finding people, we can do that. That's what we do. But obviously, those people will have a number of different opportunities, plus the opportunity they've already got. So, you know, you have to make yourself as attractive as possible to these people, you know. And that's something that we always do. So we don't want there to be any surprises in the process, and we want everyone to be aware of every single eventuality.
Yeah, and just continuing on this subject on the counter offer, because I do find it fascinating. You know, we always advise, or when I was working in my recruiting days, that you know, you take the counter offer, you'll be gone in 6 months anyway, right? And right, that's maybe not the case any longer. But my thought process is, if you've taken a counter offer at double or triple your salary, when the inevitable downturn comes, you're going to be kicked out.
That's the bluntness. All those yes. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and you know, I think the thing about counter offers is it is generally you should expect it. You know, they're you know, and you should almost be a bit worried if they don't, because does that mean the candidate's not very good, so they're not going to stay, right? So I always expect a counter offer, but if you prep it right, then you can deal with it. If someone gives like an outlandish, like you just said, three times the offer, sometimes I've just had to sit back and, you know, you kind of have been in the game a long time, so obviously you're going to take that, aren't you? Yeah, I can go and see if Mike, like, give three times what they're offering. But, you know, I think what I've seen as well is quite a lot of junior consultants. The thing about recruitment is you need to give yourself as many opportunities as possible, you know, and that would be the sort of situation to me where I would like, look, That's not going to be a winner. I'm not going to win that battle if they're going to offer them three times the salary. I would kind of, you know, like to focus my efforts on a deal that looks more set to happen, or a placement that's more set to happen. So, you know, I think at all times in recruitment, one of the things I always try and do is just think about where best to put my time. Where is the the best customers to be working with, who are the most likely candidates that we can work with and be successful for. And you have to constantly review that. You know, it's like all businesses, but the thing about recruitment is you only get paid, as I said before, you only get paid when you're successful, right? So as an individual, yes, kind of entrepreneurial business person, running your desk, running your time, you have to constantly review that. So yeah, to me, a triple salary counter offer would be one where I'd be like, well, that's not very likely to happen. I would hold my hands up and say, okay, mate, you go for that.
Go for it. Yeah, that's a difficult one to talk
about. My talent advice for you is to stay where you are.
Love it, David. So, David, I want to look at two topics, if I may. The first is what's been described as the labour market paradox, and the second is the Great Resignation. And if I can explain what we mean by the labour market paradox. So, the Financial Times, Economist, World Employment Confederation, World Economic Forum, Bloomberg have all described it as thus: you have millions of workers still unemployed or displaced, and millions of jobs open, right? There's this fundamental disconnect between supply and demand, right? And I'm sure, David, when you speak with your enterprise clients, whether they're large, medium or small, they're crying out for talent, and they're crying out for talent that they need yesterday. So my question is, how can organizations and government solve for this particular labor market paradox in your view?
Well, I think, you know, for me, I see this in two ways. The first thing is, we've always seen in places like Poland and places like maybe India as, either there's a lot of immigration kind of coming from these places. Obviously, I'm talking about the UK here, or you talk about Ireland anywhere, where the salaries are higher, okay? Or maybe in India where the work is being offshored to these types of places, and you talk about Philippines, different places as well. What I'm seeing now is the level of demand, particularly in our market, is so high, you know, and the actual logistics of working in these places has changed so much. Like you talked about remote and hybrid, is there is actually, you know, skill shortages in these locations as well. Like we spoke there, Connor, about our work, yes, in Poland. Poland is one of our fastest growing markets, you know, and we are starting to grow a market in India as well, which I never thought we'd do, but they're having difficulty finding people in India. Okay, so wow. I don't think that I think that the problem itself is globalizing, in that there's not enough people everywhere, but also salaries are increasing in places like this. So it means that there's less need to kind of move between different locations. So I think it becomes a kind of a, you know, when I say global war for talent, is where the talent is and where businesses will base themselves in order to get the talent, and how they set their global workforces up, which obviously kind of comes back to something like CXC, kind of where, you know, you're trying to support that, like a global workforce, really. It doesn't really matter where these people are based, but obviously you have to work the compliance and the contingencies and the complications of supplying people in Poland, for instance, you know. But the thing I think will help with that, and this, again, I'm talking about the technology market, and this is something we've done, and it links into things like diversity, and it links into things like kind of, you know, youth unemployment, et cetera, is that as far as I can see, and we've done quite a lot of work with this with partners and charities and non-profit organisations, is that the world of computing is very much open to people who do computer science. It's not open to people that don't, right? So therefore, you are already cutting off a huge proportion of all workforces from these great, really, really exciting, highly paid jobs. So, you know, I think it starts with education for myself. You know, it starts with education in each location, but particularly I think in places like the UK and maybe Ireland and that sort of stuff, where computing is seen as a domain for people that do maths really, really well. Now, that could be the case for some specific jobs. Obviously, we spoke about data science before, but there's so many jobs in IT. There's so many different types of jobs in IT. I spoke to someone the other day who did computer science and drama in their degree, right? And she said she was one person in her university doing it. It's one course. So one of the things we work on and think about quite a lot and talk to our clients about is, you know, changing the types of job specs they put out, changing the what they're really looking for, changing the type, the requirements, but also, you know, looking outside the box when it comes to the types of people they hire. Because what we've seen with companies that are growing very quickly and are growing in a very diverse way is that they are less focused on that computer science degree, less focused on that they have to have the perfect skill set, and more focused on cultural fit, you know, and then focus more on L&D and training and building the skills once they have these great people within their business. That's how I think that, you know, these sort of things will get solved in the long term. And I think it will increasingly become a kind of global problem. You know, the reason why India produces more IT people is because their education system is fully focused on producing lots of IT people. You know, that's one of the key things that people do at school. And in some cultures, you know, UK and Ireland, I don't think they do that even 5 or 10% of what places like India do. And that's the real problem.
Yeah, I agree with you, David. I think there's that structural barrier in education generally that prevents people from getting into things like IT or computer science. If you think about some of the talent that young people out there that don't have access to opportunity to go to college or university, but they've got logic and the ability to translate that logic into programming. And I think of things like, Digital Futures, where Sean Simdall's the chairman of, they're essentially upskilling or reskilling people that are interested in working in technology jobs and giving them the pathway, the skills, the training to do that. I think we need to almost redesign what our education system looks like, but also as employers and representatives of employers, to your point, we need to be sending them, listen, do you really need a degree for this particular job? Because if I think about my own working career, David, over the last 20 odd years now, some of the best people I've worked with didn't go to university, right? They've got natural intelligence, resilience, lateral thinking, get up and go energy, positivity, they're creative, they've got vision, they can see things that other people can't see. And that can't be taught, right? That a lot of that, those qualities that I've mentioned there are innate. And when I think about the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow, it strikes me that our education system needs almost completely redesigned. Would you agree with that or disagree?
I definitely think that if we're talking with the context of there's a lot of IT jobs, there's not enough people to do IT, okay? That, yeah, definitely the education system needs to be changed. But I do also think that it's inherent to the employers as well to look outside the box. You know, there's so many different subjects that you can do at school, right? So you're never going to be able to get, unless you're really, really focused and you work on Linux servers in your bedroom and that sort of stuff, you're never going to be able to get the level of IT knowledge that the only 5 or 10% of the workforce will have because they're computer science degrees. But that does not mean they can't do it. So yeah, I really believe and appreciate things like Digital Futures that do that. The other thing, you know, we work with a company an organisation called FIT in Ireland, and they do a lot of work with people who've dropped out of education, you know, and they just, you know, they say, like, you know, these are people that we can now train up with a vocation, almost like an apprenticeship, to kind of put them into those people. So again, it's all about upskilling people that are not your average, you know, not the normal people to kind of go into IT. And But IT is a complete meritocracy and does not care where you come from as long as you can do the skills. So so I think it's all part of that. I think it's education, but it's also prevalent to the IT industry and people looking for these types of candidates to open up their minds a little bit and think outside the box.
Yeah, I think that's fair comment, David. And David, I just want to touch on what's been described as the Great Resignation or the so-called Great Resignation. And I read a paper by a lady called
Anita Letinkler. It's an oxymoron, isn't it? The Great Resignation.
It is. Do you know, I love it. No, it's not bloody great, right?
But the blasted resignation.
I read this. The blasted resignation, the infernal resignation, right? But yeah, but I read Anita's white paper back in November or December, and I've described it as a punch there moment. And essentially, David, Anita was questioning the received wisdom or narrative that the Great Resignation is a universal thing. And in short, what her paper says is that it's particularly prevalent in the United States, and really the term came around from a Microsoft study in March 2020 when the pandemic was beginning around this move to working remote. So it sounds part marketing, part real in the USA. But what Anita found was that the labor participation rates or resignation rates hadn't changed in UK, Germany or Netherlands, right, in those three markets. So, and also just anecdotally, David, how many software developers are resigning, right? How many university tutors or teachers are resigning? Like, I mean, is it really, in your view, is it real or is it imagined? What's your take on it, David? What are you seeing as a CEO in the recruitment world?
Well, I would say statistically, there was definitely more people available for work during during COVID than there were post-COVID, right? Now, that obviously, those people weren't resigning, they were out of work, right? So the levels of available candidates have gone down since the economy recovered post-COVID. Is there a great resignation? I would also suggest that there has been people changing their jobs. Maybe they put it off during COVID. I think this is part of Microsoft's kind of original thing that, you know, there would be a great resignation, but it's been held up because no one would resign during COVID. You know, you would just wouldn't. You just hang on to the job you've got before you got to the other side. So I do think we've seen that within our own business, you know, and we've seen it within the businesses that we work with, you know, and I think that drives some levels of higher volume of recruitment. But I do think that people were prepared. You know, I do think people, companies, organisations knew that this was a risk, and I think they have mitigated it. And I think, you know, COVID has taught us a lot about team building, about the type of workplace that we can create, about the how important our kind of, you know, key workers are. And when I say key workers, I mean the kind of key members of our team, as well as key workers themselves. And I think, you know, the workers and the employees are much more respected and, you know, helped now. It's definitely something we tried to do within GCS. You know, we brought in kind of systems like Peakon and different sorts of kind of benefits and, you know, really trying to kind of work with our client candidates ourselves, our own people, to build their careers and opportunities. So for me, you know, I think this was the Great Resignation was something that people knew would probably come. Okay, so therefore you could prepare yourself. Something like COVID, obviously you'd heard risks and warnings, but you probably didn't really think anything like that would ever happen, so you couldn't prepare yourself. But I do think people took quite kind of mitigating factors, and really what that meant was they improved their workplaces. You know, they listened to people, they gave more flexible working, they helped people through COVID, you know, and I think that has built up more loyalty than potentially people predicted.
Yeah, I love that. I love your answer there, David. It chimes a lot with what I experienced and what we experienced during the heights of the pandemic, and I really appreciate the thoughtfulness that you put into that, David. David, I want to move on, if we may, to automation and its potential impact on jobs displacement. So there's an economist I'm always speaking about called Vasily Leontief, and he did a piece of research. It's quite old now, about 40 years ago. And essentially, he looked at horses in New York and at the turn of the 19th century. And there's something like 20 million odd horses in New York. And then the combustion engine came along. And in the space of about 20 years, horses were completely displaced and ultimately, and unfortunately for horses, eliminated. And his thesis or hypothesis is that humans, due to increased automation, will be the new horses. So what's your take on that rather dystopian view?
Just to go back to the horses, you know, I mean, I guess, did they all get killed off or...
There was a lot of culling. There was a lot of culling. I hope the machines don't do that to us, David. Of course, but there was a lot of culling.
The horses' lives nowadays seem quite nice, really, don't they? They're mostly in the fields. They get like nice little jobs around. They're like super looked after in terms of like the horses for horse racing, so I guess they have still have specific uses, right? So to use that kind of horse analogy,
they do.
Yeah, they're still needed in very specific things, and I guess to take that analogy forward, like we've done quite a lot on the podcast that we do, which is kind of leaders series where we've talked about people and automation. I think that automation will drive decision making, and it should drive decision making as opposed to help people do business and live their normal lives, right? It will not be the decision maker. You know, I cannot see that it will be your boss, right? It will make the decision on whether you get hired, because, you know, like we just said right at the start about the talent marketplaces, there are certain things that automation can do, but there's many things that it cannot do, you know. So it can help you make decisions, but it's not as good at making decisions, and probably, again, talk about dystopian world, probably not the best it's probably not the best thing to make decisions, you know. You know, you could argue with what's going on in the world, we're living in like a war time with Ukraine and stuff like that, that maybe we should leave the decisions to machines. But I think the most important thing for me about that is the way I see automation helping recruiters, for instance, is that it will help us to do parts of our job that are not as valuable. And the things that are important in our job are helping our customers and helping our candidates and speaking to them and finding them fantastic opportunities or fantastic candidates for their clients. 80% of my time is spent maybe as a recruiter trying to find those people to talk to, you know. Now, if I could get automation tools that help me to get to those people quicker, then I can spend more time doing great work, more time supporting my customers, which hopefully will help my customers to do better and help my candidates to find better jobs and push the economy forward. So therefore, there's more opportunities for everyone and we all have a better life. So I go back to the part of this where I said, I think that it will help people. I don't think that it will, you know, stop business happening. I don't believe there will be a robot CEO of Microsoft in 10 years. I don't believe there will be a robot US president in 50 years. Okay. I think that it will be there to help us make decisions and hopefully help make better decisions to do more important, valuable parts of our job. And that it will help humanity and help industry to be better.
I like how you've turned the dystopian, rather dystopian view that I
turned into a Nirvana now.
You have. I tell you what, I could feel myself going on that right, journey with you, David. Right. Thinking, geez, I'd like to go there. So thank you for that, David. I want to come up, keep on the technology front, and I want to ask just your views on HR tech investment. We'll come back to that in a moment, if we may, but. I just want to touch briefly on remote work, because from what I understand in the candidate market, it's a hot topic, but also there's a lot of industry gurus out there saying that remote work and fully remote work is the best thing ever, right? Nothing compares to it. No organization can survive in the modern world without offering fully distributed remote work. I take some issue with that, right? And I'm wondering what your viewpoint is. Is the hybrid model maybe the best model for businesses generally, or at least your business? Or do you think there's a lot of guru type people out there overselling the benefits of remote work? What's your take on it?
Well, at GCS, we're a hybrid organisation now, so that we allow people to work in the office as and when they want to, and we have, you know, set specific days when everyone kind of gets together and works. So we find that works really well for us. And has worked really well, has been a sea change since the start of the pandemic. I think there are problems in each way of working. And I think that, you know, it's like all things, there's pros and cons, right? And that's the thing that we're really, you know, starting to find out. You know, if you work too much from home, I think you get disconnected from the company. And then all the things that kind of happen from being in the office all the time, you know, presenteeism, you know, you can get much more distracted, you know, being in the office than being at home. So I think what's important really is, you know, I think that it's difficult now in this day and age to be a fully in the office workplace, because many companies aren't. So therefore, you're going to be facing an uphill struggle to say everyone's got to be in the office all the time. But I also think that, you know, creating an entirely remote culture does have its disadvantages, and I think you have to be quite aware of that. You know, it's a way you can go, right? You can make this decision, and lots of companies do. But I think if you think it's like we talked about, the joke about Nirvana, and there's not going to be any negative aspects of this, then you're wrong, you know. So it's really about, you know, making sure you're aware of the risks inherent in that type of kind of workplace culture, and that you're, you know, like we talked about when we were talking about the Great Resignation, that you're making, you know, you can see this coming. This won't be a surprise if the things that came out of this will happen. So you should do things about it. You know, I spoke to a client the other day that, you know, that all the money they're saving on office space, they're setting up, like, you know, 2-week hubs in really nice places where all their employees will go along with their families, you know. And I thought, oh, that's a brilliant idea, you know. You can do that. That sounds fantastic, you know. But
yeah,
if you didn't do that and you were remote all the time and nobody ever got together and never worked together, I don't think you'd have a culture, and that's key. So you've got to know the pros and cons of each decision you make.
I agree with you, David, actually, and I just had another question that came to mind. Have you changed your leadership style due to the hybrid remote way of working?
I think that I think for me, like, the way I would say, I think leadership is a lot about vision and where you want to take the business. So for me, this what's happened with COVID is something we've had to build a new vision around, and it's a vision that I really, really believe in. So I think now, bearing in mind we've done the MBO and I've been with the business for 25 years, this is one of the most exciting times that I've ever known of working for GCS, just with regards to the opportunities we have, the growth we're doing, the opportunities we can give to people within their careers and the customers we're working with. So I think my leadership style is almost, you know, I'm able to present a vision much better because, you know, I've had to, you know, under crisis, come up with some ideas that are going to take us out of this crisis. And now I really, really believe in those ideas. And I've got a great management team around me that really believe in those ideas. And I think that makes you a stronger leader. Whether my leadership style has changed, I don't know. And there's always things you can work on, but my vision has changed, that's for sure.
Appreciate it, David. And David, I just want to touch on the tech investment piece. So I've read various reports that HR tech investment last year was between $12 billion US dollars and $18 billion US dollars. Do you feel that there's a bubble building in HR technology, or do you think this is an entirely natural response to the new way of working?
Well, Engage Talent, because our group has also rebranded itself, we would like to see ourselves as a part of HR tech. So I hope it's not a bubble that's going to burst, because, you know, we see ourselves as a platform that will help our customers to recruit better, you know, and find better staff and deal with talent problems easier. So, yeah, we see our role as being part of HR technology, as well as just kind of core normal staffing. I don't know, really. I think, you know, whenever I've heard people talk in leadership, and I've done quite a lot of podcasts on leaders myself, people always talk about how important people are within their business, right? But people never really invest in it. This goes back to what we said about the kind of recruitment being a bit of a, you know, underrated industry, or, you know, people moan about it quite a lot. I think it's just people are starting to recognise how important it is to find really, really good people, and how important it is to invest in finding really good people, whether that be technology, services, you know, recruitment, staffing, talent, etc., etc. So, I mean, obviously, staffing is always a something that is linked to high levels of recruitment. So when that goes down, then that would probably break that. But I can't see that going down anytime soon, particularly within the markets we work within. So I genuinely think that it's a case that people are starting to recognise it more, you know, that we are talent consultants, that we are professionals. You know, I've always thought that we are more like a lawyer or an accountant or a solicitor than we're given credit for. You know, we help to run businesses and build platforms and structures that are integral to businesses and enterprises and corporates, that is really important. Like lawyers, like solicitors, like accountants, like IT people, you know. And I think what I'm trying to say there is that people should judge that HR tech industry as such, that it's a really, really important part of running a business and should not be overlooked.
Yeah, I think that's become clear, very clear actually, David, over the last nearly 2 years. I think it's crucial, and I think many organizations have had to walk the walk and really live that, mainly through government dictation. Suddenly you can't go into your office, suddenly people can't travel, and people are being mandated to work from home. And also, you know, millions of people obviously were put out of jobs, albeit supported by government. So I think we've all had to walk that particular walk and stop talking about this, but actually act and do something meaningful around it. So I love your thoughts on that. And David, if we can finish with this, what if any is your prediction for the future of work?
I do think there's been a sea change with technology and COVID coming together. I think it will be a lot more remote and a lot more hybrid. And I think that, you know, the office workplace as you and I knew it will be as kind of, you know, extinguished as, like, you know, you mentioned there, Connor, about the fax machine at some point in our conversation, you know. Yes. I think it will change. You know, I think the future of work is a lot more global, a lot more virtual, and the companies that embrace that and do well within it will be the companies that kind of win in the future. I do think that it's not the end of the office. It's not the end of teams working within an organisation. I do think that it will look different, but it will still have the same, you know, still have the same importance to create a great culture where people work together for an organisation. And I'm pleased by that, because I think there's certain things that were broken and certain things that weren't. And I think, you know, we need to kind of work that out. And at GCS, we're really happy to kind of be part of that kind of conversation and those changes. So.
Well, David, thank you very much for that answer. And I have to say, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. It's been excellent. And it's been good. And it's been lovely to hear your thoughtfulness and consideration around all those topics. And I really felt we went on a journey, David, and a really good one at that. So, David, thanks so much for your time. We and I really appreciate it, and I know our listeners are really going to enjoy this. So, David, if you're comfortable with this, where is the best place for our listeners to contact you should they need a recruitment solution or some talent advisory work?
Fortunately, with the surname Bloxham, there's not many of me on LinkedIn. So if you look at type in David Bloxham GCS, you'll find me, and I will be there, happy to take your direct message or comment on my LinkedIn status or connection. So yes, that's probably the best way.
Great stuff. Well, David, thanks again. We really appreciate your time, and have a great day ahead. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Connor. Cheers.